Now, I'm delighted to be talking with the Speaker of the House of Commons, the Right Honourable John Bercow, MP. So first off, may I express my thanks to for talking to us at Phoenix FM today. Mr. Speaker Bercow, it's a pleasure. Perhaps I could start off by briefly asking you to outline the role of the Speaker.
Yes, there are really three aspects to the role. First, and this is much the best known and the most visible function of the Chair, the Speaker chairs in the chamber, chairs question times, including Prime Minister's questions, chairs debates, chairs the delivery by ministers of statements, that is to say, announcements to the House. So chairing in the chamber as the referee or umpire, facilitating debate, calling people to speak, is the first and best-known function. The second is to chair the House of Commons Commission, which is the strategic governing body of the House, responsible for its staff, services and property. And I serve as chairman of that commission by virtue of being Speaker. And thirdly, I meet and greet visitors from across the country and around the world. It might mean greeting you in Speaker's House, Scott, today for the purposes of this interview. It might mean greeting a group of school children, which I very regularly do, or it might mean greeting a visiting dignitary from another country, a visiting Speaker, a visiting Foreign Secretary, a visiting Ambassador, etc., etc. So those are the three main functions. I've added a fourth, which is to try to be an ambassador for Parliament and a robust advocate of democratic politics who gets out beyond the Palace of Westminster to talk to groups around the country. And that, Scott, of course, is how you and I met.
Indeed.
I had the pleasure of speaking to the Canvey Island U3A only a very few weeks ago. So I've got my three core functions, and I have cheekily added a fourth.
Good stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Now, you were elected to the office of Speaker at about the time that the scandal over MPs' expenses erupted, which must have been a bit of a baptism of fire for you. Is this an issue over which the Speaker has any influence, or merely a matter for the House of Commons standards bodies and individual political parties?
It's very much more now a matter for the independent Parliamentary Standards Authority. We had to configure a new system because the system was broken, and we had suffered reputational carnage, as you imply, so I suppose becoming Speaker at that time was to a degree a baptism of fire. The House resolved to hand over the determination of MPs' expenses and ultimately of pay to an independent body. That body now deals with it, and if there are cases arising from members' use of expenses, which is questionable or worthy of investigation, then IPSA will authorise an investigation into a member's conduct to take place. So that is not in any way, shape or form a matter for me. The only thing really I can...
You can get out from under.
I can get out from under, as you put it. But the only thing really that remains in any way a matter for the Speaker is the question of how a member apologises to the House if required to do so. So when a member is found guilty of some infraction of one sort or another, by a report of the Standards Committee of the House, and the member has accepted that, the whole process has been gone through, the member will have to apologise in some cases to the House, and the Speaker has a say over when that's done. And the Speaker has to see the text of what the member proposes to say by way of explanation and apology, because it must not be argumentative. The member must simply apologise, and the House wants the Speaker, if you like, to act as referee of the appropriateness of what the member is going to say. But beyond that, I really now have no role in these matters.
Okay, going on from that, do you think that democracy is damaged by MPs awarding themselves a 10% pay increase whilst ordinary members of the public may be struggling to meet their bills without any appreciable increase in their income for many years? Can that be justified?
Well, I'm sorry to take you back to the question, but you say, do I think that the reputation of the House of Commons is damaged by members of Parliament awarding themselves a pay increase? But that is precisely what members of Parliament haven't done. The House decided that IPSA would be in charge of expenses and ultimately of pay. IPSA has taken responsibility for deciding what MPs' pay should be.
Yeah.
So it is IPSA that decided that there should be a pay rise. Members of Parliament haven't decided that.
Right.
And there is an automaticity about it. That is to say, once the decision is made, it simply happens. I think it is only fair to say that the pay rise, though many people will regard it as considerable, has also been accompanied by other changes,
yeah,
the effect of which causes IPSA to say, not me to say, not the Prime Minister to say, not the leader of the opposition to say, causes IPSA to say that changes are cost neutral. So the consequence of the changes that IPSA has decreed, not advised, but decreed, is cost neutral as far as the taxpayer is concerned. Now, do the public approve of MPs having a pay rise at a time when a lot of other people are not? They may very well not do so. There is no special locus. You're interviewing me about my role as Speaker, of the Speaker here. The Speaker
has no special
locus whatsoever. A judgment is made by an independent body. If you're asking me what do I think what I would say to you is this. If we decide that the determination of MPs' pay should be done independently, then we should say what we mean and mean what we say. We've decided it should be done independently.
Yeah.
Now, if what some people think is that MPs' pay shouldn't go up at all, well, then they're not really arguing the question of whether MPs should set their pay or someone else should set their pay. They're just saying that if ever a pay rise is decided on, it must immediately be rejected. And what I'm saying is neither that MPs' pay should rise nor that MPs' pay should fall. What I am saying is I personally believe very strongly that the question of MPs' pay should be determined separately from, independently of, and without in any sense being repudiated or overridden by members of Parliament. Let it be done by an independent body. That's what people always said they wanted. These MPs shouldn't set their own pay.
That's right.
But it's now set by an independent body.
Can't have it both ways.
All right. That is really my attitude. You know, it's either independent or it's not independent. And if it is independent, that's their judgment.
Let's come directly on to things that, that you as a Speaker are probably going to be involved with. Because you're very much a moderniser in the way you conduct yourself as a Speaker. You've simplified the dress code. So I want to ask you a little bit about the way Parliament operates, because Parliaments in Scotland, Wales and other parts of Europe have delegates that kind of sit in a semicircle, and it's been suggested that the design at Westminster with parties facing one another tends to result in a rather combative style of debate. If both houses of Westminster have to be relocated whilst repairs are carried out in the existing buildings, would you be in favour of the seating arrangements being changed?
I've never argued for the seating arrangements to be changed. I think there is quite a strong likelihood that even if we do spend a period outside of this place, a pop-up chamber on the parliamentary estate will be preserved. And personally, I must say, Scott, I think there are good reasons for that. I think it increases the pressure a bit on the contractors if we don't allow the field to be occupied exclusively by somebody else. Mm-hmm. So maintaining some sort of presence on the parliamentary estate in the form of a chamber, I think, is useful. Now, I'm not saying that that will be the chamber of the House of Commons as it stands now. It wouldn't be. It would be some other chamber. Have I heard any pressure for there to be a circular chamber? The honest answer is that I haven't heard any such pressure. There will be different views, and I accept that it's a debatable point. But if you ask me, do I mainly attribute the relatively tribal character of our political system to the seating arrangements, the honest answer is I don't. I don't think that's a significant factor. I think that there is a great tradition to a rather aggressive, feisty, sometimes disruptive style, and I've often said I think that it could be done with more decorum and greater dignity and a lower decibel level. I don't myself regard the configuration of the chamber as being a major factor. Often what people who argue that mean is that they would also like the voting system to be more like that of, for example, a number of the continental European countries, you know, a proportional representation system or something
like that. Well, I've got something on that to come up.
And they're perfectly entitled to that view, but I've never advocated it.
In some assemblies, it's not uncommon for politicians to applaud the contributions of parliamentarians. And, of course, when newly arrived at Westminster, SNP members needed to be rebuked for this kind of display. What are your views on that? Because, of course, it's happened since now.
Yes. I mean, I think the very fact that it happens so rarely rather proves the merit of it ordinarily not happening. In the case just after the arrival of the SNP members when they applauded. I absolutely accept they weren't intending any discourtesy. It was a spontaneous outburst of applause for a particular speech. But it was not
otherwise.
Because
they're used to it in Scotland.
And because they're used to it in the Scottish Parliament. They are accustomed to that culture. Mm. But it wasn't an exceptional occasion. Mm. In any way, it wasn't a special debate. There was nothing particularly historic about it at all. And I thought that it was better straight away to nip it in the bud and say, look, you know, I'll always stand up for the rights of Scottish National Party members to question, to probe, to scrutinise, to challenge, to contradict the government of the day, to punch their weight. But I hope if I respect their rights, they'll respect the traditions of the House. And one of the traditions of the House is that we don't have clapping 99 times out of 100, 999 times out of 1,000 in debates. We don't have clapping. Now, Scott, to be fair, I would say two things. First of all, they've accepted it. Mm. And secondly, if the House willed it otherwise, the Speaker is the servant of the House. Mm-hmm. The House isn't the servant of the Speaker. I'm the House's servant. So if the House wanted to change that arrangement and say, well, actually, we think it would be perfectly normal to have clapping, and why shouldn't we? Let's change. Mm. Then I would respect that. But I felt that day, as I would always feel, my responsibility was to act on behalf and with the almost certain expectation of the support of a majority in the House.
Would the House need to vote on that to change it?
I think the House would almost certainly need to vote. Yeah. I don't think it would be something that could just be allowed to happen. Right. I think the House would have a view about it. There are members who feel very strongly that clapping on anything of a regular basis is wrong. It has happened on, I think, one occasion since.
Yes.
And on that occasion, I didn't stop it. And somebody could very legitimately say to me, well, John, you did on the one occasion, not on the other. How do you explain that? And the answer is that you've got to be pragmatic. And on the second occasion when it happened right across the House.
Yes.
In all parts of the House, not just on one set of benches, but across the House, and it was quite determined and, I won't say coordinated, but in no way, you know, an accident.
No.
It was a calculated decision by a lot of members, and I thought, well, this won't last all that long, and rather than interrupt ineffectively, because it may well have been an ineffective interruption, the House was enjoying itself, I thought that it was practical and prudent simply to let it take its very brief course. And it did take, to be fair, Scott, a very brief course, and we then moved on.
Fair enough. Now, in debates, especially the major sessions like Prime Minister's Questions, you call on people wishing to speak. Now, I'm curious to know whether you are given prior notice of members who might want to be called and the points or questions they might want to raise. And I ask this particularly because during a fairly recent Prime Minister's Question Time, the Prime Minister was able to produce statistics relating to the member in question's constituency, which suggests that he must at least have been expecting something from that member. Was he given prior notice to such a question being raised?
Well, I don't know of the particular case, but what I would say is that I would have prior notice of what a member was going to ask only if he or she had indicated to me a particular desire to be called in order to put a particular question.
Right.
Now, Scott, does that happen? Yes, it does. Members sometimes come to me and say, oh, Mr. Speaker, I'm really keen to get in today, either at Prime Minister's Questions or at another time question, another question time session. I'm not on the order paper, but I would like to ask a supplementary question because there's a particular issue in my constituency or whatever. And in those circumstances, I would be aware that happens every week.
Yep.
But does it happen dozens of times a week? No, I would say probably once a week somebody will tip me off that they particularly want to raise a point. Mm. And I usually make no commitment, almost unfailingly I would make no commitment. I would just say I'll bear it in mind.
Yep.
Some weeks it might happen three times, the next week it might not happen at all. As to what the Prime Minister knows, I think the short answer to you is this. If a member has been drawn lucky in the ballot and is therefore on the order paper to ask a question, others get called to ask supplementaries, but there's a certain number of people on the order paper. If the member is on the order paper, the Prime Minister will know that member's name is on the order paper, and the Prime Minister will have genned up about that member's constituency to a degree.
Yep.
And that might explain why the Prime Minister is ready with a full reply with statistics and so on. It might do if, for example, the Prime Minister's office has prepared a brief on very straightforward issues like the state of the economy in that member's constituency. That might explain why the Prime Minister's got a ready grasp of the issues. Or it might be that the member has tipped the Prime Minister off. Prime Minister, I'm specifically going to ask about education in my constituency or about the health service or whatever, in which case the Prime Minister would make sure that he was properly briefed.
Otherwise he'd have to be a mind reader.
Yes, I mean, no, he is either making a point on the basis of a general briefing about the member's constituency, or he's been tipped off. And in some cases, certainly in relation to Prime Minister's questions, there will have been discussion behind the scenes about what is going to be raised.
Yeah.
Now, that does happen. It's happened under successive governments. You know, you ask me, well, you know, has the Prime Minister been informed by the member of what he's going, he, the member, is going to ask? Well, that will often be the case. Equally, in some cases, members agree to put questions which the government thinks will be helpful. Now, that's not something that the Speaker encourages, but it's not something for the Speaker to stop either. That's happened under successive governments. So for a number of reasons, in a number of different scenarios, the Prime Minister could certainly be aware of matters, including statistics and policies relevant in the member's constituency.
How do you, as Speaker, choose participants who might want to contribute to a debate whilst at the same time trying to keep things balanced?
Well, the answer is, in general terms, I go back and forth from one side to the other. If a particular question is grouped with another similar question, that will often, not always, but often mean calling two people from the same side in succession. But in that case, I would then call two people in succession from the other side, assuming there were two standing interested in being called. But in very broad terms, the Speaker generally goes back and forth from one side of the House to the other, so there is at least a balance between the two sides of the House. Beyond that, for what am I looking? Well, I'm looking, Scott, to call a mixture of members elected 40 years ago up to members elected in May of last year. I'm looking to call female members as well as male. I'm looking to call people from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland as well as from England. I'm looking to call people from different parts of those constituent parts of the United Kingdom. So I have to know every member. I have to know the name of every member and every member's constituency.
Can't be easy.
No, I didn't say it's easy, but of course 400 or so of them you know anyway because you've been with them in the previous Parliament. And then there can be a couple of hundred new members after an election. There isn't always, but there can be. There were 227 new members in 2010 and a little over 180 new members this time round. And how do I get to know them all? Well, a book is published by the House very quickly of the new members elected with pictures of those new members and details, names of their constituencies, and I learn 20 or 30 a day for about a week until I know.
I can imagine that's a real baptism of fire.
Well, it's quite a challenge, but I mean, I think that one quality, whatever you think of the Speaker of the day and whatever your listeners think of me, one attribute that the Speaker does require is a reasonably good memory.
Right.
You know, you have to have a good memory for names and preferably for constituencies. And so, yes, there is quite a lot to remember, but it's a task, an enjoyable task.
Yes.
But it's a discipline, and therefore, you know, you get used to it.
Of course.
I don't necessarily have to remember other people's names or other details or other facts, but it's pretty much meat and drink that the Speaker should remember the names of colleagues.
Now, I guess before you became Speaker, you might potentially have crossed swords with whips. Now, some people take the view that the role of the whips is crucial to the maintenance of party discipline so that the electorate clearly understands what party stands for, whilst others believe that their actions might serve to reinforce a public perception that MPs are just acting as cannon fodder for the party at the expense of the views of the constituents. In your view, should there be a greater element of freedom for politicians to vote with genuine conviction? Or could this increase the risk of undue outside influence and potential corruption?
I certainly don't think there's any danger of outside influence in a negative sense. There's no evidence of any sort of organised or orchestrated machinery that is designed to subvert
MPs who've been badgered by various interest groups to push various views, have we not?
Well, I mean, you say that various interest groups badger members of Parliament. I mean, that's all part of the democratic and political process. So, I mean, I said he wouldn't want to characterise it in sinister terms. I mean, organisations are perfectly entitled to lobby their local MP, or indeed to lobby MPs more widely to try to build support for a cause or opposition to a cause. And, of course, if you take, you know, a sensitive issue like hunting with dogs, well, sure, if there is a debate on the matter, then both sides, both campaigns, lobby very hard, and they produce opinion poll results, and they try to persuade members of Parliament that what they, as a campaign, are saying is not just right, but also popular. And so there is a degree of influence brought to bear there, but I think most of my colleagues are pretty robust, and they're
accustomed to that. To the chase, though, do you think that the...
Well, I have cut to the chase.
Well, with the whips, do you agree with the fact that... that the whips should continue in the way that they do, or should parliamentarians have a freer hand?
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I mean, I think that there is no particular problem to be addressed here. I mean, ultimately, members of Parliament can assert themselves if they so wish. There are what are called conscience votes on a fair number of issues in the House. I think it's perfectly understandable that a political party will want to exert a degree of discipline and have an organised approach to policy promotion and the passage of legislation. So if you're asking me, you know, do I in some sort of purist way side with those who think that the whip system stinks? No, I don't agree with that. And I think, to be honest, that some of the people who disparage or despise the very existence of the whips don't quite understand the way that parliamentary government operates. I mean, in a modern state... and a modern society, you have to have some degree of organisation behind the way Parliament does things. And if you are to have a government and for a government to be sustained, there has to be an element of party discipline behind it. And members of Parliament are, of course, elected to Parliament not purely as individuals or even principally as individuals. They are elected under a banner. In almost every case, they are either a Conservative or Labour or Liberal Democrat or Scottish Nationalist or Green or whatever. So, you know, I think party discipline is perfectly reasonable. However, colleagues in the end have got to decide whether when they feel strongly and their view is different from their party, they are going to be prepared to assert themselves. And I can only say really two things. First of all, every member has to decide this for him or herself. Is there something especially oppressive about the present climate? No. In fact, the evidence is that the House of Commons is more independent-minded and members of Parliament are more assertive in sticking up for their own views against their party than at any time in the post-war period. The level of rebellion in the Labour years was very high. The level of rebellion over the last 6 years under the Conservative Lib Dem coalition and now under the Conservatives operating as a government alone has been very high. So although you sometimes get people sort of asking about career politicians and people wanting to advance themselves, and it's certainly true we are in an era of career politicians, we are also, just as a matter of fact, in an era of far more independent-minded members of Parliament than at any time I can remember. All the research, the serious research, shows that MPs are rebelling against the party whip more often than at any time in the post-war period. And my only other observation is that I can simply speak from my own experience. I did what I wanted to do. I mainly supported my party, the Conservative Party, but when I wanted to rebel, I rebelled. I just decided, well, I'm going to do my own thing. As a courtesy, I would let the whips know if I was going to rebel. And I think the whips have got an important role, but also they should know their place. And as far as I'm concerned, I can say to you only that when I was a Conservative backbencher in the later years, I had a relationship with the whips characterised by trust and understanding. I didn't trust them and they didn't understand me.
Now, we touched on the question of PR. Views have been expressed that whilst the electorate can go to the polls every 5 years, that whatever the result, we effectively end up with an elective dictatorship. Would you care to comment on this, and also whether that now we seem to be entering a much more multi-party system, Do you feel that the present voting system is still fit for purpose? And if not, what changes might be workable and how should such changes be established?
I'm not arguing for change in the electoral system. I certainly accept that for so long as parties, the bigger parties, are getting, as they have tended to continue to get, below 40% of the vote, there will be contestation on this matter, there will be continued argument, and there will be people who say, well, the system doesn't work as well as it should. And that is a debatable point, but the simple fact is that we did have a referendum on electoral reform in 2011. That is to say, fewer than 5 years ago, we had a referendum on the alternative vote system, and the proposal of reform was heavily defeated. And I think, Scott, it's fair to say that on a matter of this kind, which is essentially a constitutional matter, it is perfectly proper for it to be resolved, if necessary, by referendum from time to time. But I think the general convention is that such matters are treated of in referenda every few decades. I mean, conceivably, it could be more frequent than that. But would you have a referendum on electoral reform every 5 years? Realistically, you wouldn't. We've had a referendum on that matter, and the call for change was decisively rejected. So do I see any sign that there's going to be a referendum on that matter again soon? The honest answer is I don't see any such sign. If it happened, well, everybody would have a vote, and I would cast my vote in the privacy of the ballot, and it's not for me to take, as Speaker, a high-profile position on the issue.
Not.
But if you ask me, do I have a sort of track record of campaigning for electoral reform, the answer is I don't. I think there are a lot of things that we can do to improve the standing of Parliament and the quality of representation and the effectiveness of scrutiny that takes place in Westminster, and which are unrelated to the question of the operation of our electoral system.
Okay, well, perhaps we could finish on a light note. If you suddenly found yourself Prime Minister, what's the one thing you'd like to do?
Because I don't think in terms of government and decision-making, I can honestly tell you that I have never thought about what I would do if I were Prime Minister. If I had untrammelled control, who knows? If I could choose a reform that I would like to see made, it would be to establish a House, capital H, Business, capital B, Committee, capital C, which would, as a group, as a committee, as a body of colleagues, decide on the scheduling of parliamentary business. Now, it may be, listening to me say this, your eyes will glaze over and you'll think, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, it's got a lot to do with the way Parliament works at the moment. Although we have several debates chosen by our backbench business committee, that is true of what we call non-government business. Government business is basically scheduled by the government, and it is done by the government chief whip in consultation with the opposition chief whip, but with the government chief whip very much in command, and nobody else really gets much of a look in. My own long-standing view has been that we ought to have a more democratic and transparent process for deciding which subjects are debated, which bills, in which order, and for what length of time. And I think it would be another example of the very proper and welcome assertion of parliamentary strength if the House of Commons decided to establish such a committee. We were supposed to get one in the last Parliament, and the government didn't come forward with that proposal, but it's perfectly open to my colleagues to resuscitate that plan and to insist on it if they so wish.
Well, look, I could talk to you all day, but I know you're a very busy man, so I've got to let you go and get on. But thank you very much for taking the time out to talk to us today. That's the Right Honourable Mr. John Bercow, MP, Speaker of the House of Commons.
Scott, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.